The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, editor for our online daily news site, is here to talk about some recent stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on the coloration of ancient marine reptiles. We're able to tell a lot about ancient animals from fossilized bones, size, shape, method of locomotion, but figuring out what ancient animals look like to anyone not using x-rays has remained a real challenge. So, Dave, how are paleontologists going beyond the bones?
Well, in the past few years, paleontologists have developed some cool new methods for figuring out what some of these ancient creatures have looked like, but they've mainly applied them to fossil birds. And in this new study, they apply them to some ancient marine reptiles. Three animals in particular, leatherback turtle that lived about 55 million years ago, a mosasaur, which kind of looked like a bit like a sea serpent, and that lived about 86 million years ago, and then an ichthyosaur, which lived about 190 million years ago. These creatures all lived in the seas of the time.
And so these are ancient creatures that we have fossils of, but how did they actually try to find out how they looked?
Well, what happens with some of these fossils is that there are, in the rock that the fossil is embedded in, there's actually outlines of soft tissue that presents as sort of a dull black material. And for a long time, scientists just thought these were just remnants of tissues, that they weren't very important. But when the researchers looked at these materials, looked at these black outlines with a scanning electron microscope, they saw these dense layers of these tiny rugby ball-shaped structures. And these tiny bits are the same size and the same shape as pigment-bearing structures called melanosomes found in the skin of modern-day lizards and also in the feathers of birds. And based on the shape of these structures, the researchers conclude that the pigments they were looking at were black.
Okay, so they're not actually testing the chemical composition of this material. They're rather looking at the shape of it?
Well, they also bombarded the fossils with charged particles, and they analyzed these particles. They also found evidence of a dark pigment, one that typically lends a black or brown color to skin or feathers.
They're able to actually see the color. Well, but did they have any patterns, or did they look like animals that we know about today?
Well, yeah, when they took a closer look, they found that the patterns were actually very similar to sea creatures that are seen today. And what they were basically seeing was a darker pattern on sort of the back of the animal or the dorsal side, and a lighter pattern on the ventral or belly side. And that actually makes a lot of sense because a lot of these animals are predators. And basically what happens is you have a dark backside and a lighter underside. It actually provides very nice camouflage in the water, helps you sneak up on prey. The dark backside also confers some other advantages. These animals would have been swimming in very cold waters. And when they went up to the surface, they were actually all air breathers. And when they went up to the surface, this dark backside actually helped them absorb sunlight. If you think about wearing a dark t-shirt on a sunny day, that helped them warm up after a long time in some very frigid waters.
So far, we've seen some of this research in birds, and now we have marine reptiles. Is there another place to go?
Well, we're seeing a lot more of this, and so the idea is obviously that we'd like to get a much better sense of some of the other ancient animals that lived around this time, not only for our curiosity, but actually these colors can shed a lot of light on the behavior of these animals as well.
Next up, we have a story on making new friends but not keeping the old. The question is, do we have a friend quota? Do we keep the same number of friends constant while swapping people in and out of those roles? So, Dave, why are we asking this question? What suggests that there might be an upper limit on our friend upkeep?
Well, having friends is very nice, and having close friends is not just nice, but actually can be important. Friends, especially close friendships, are vital to our health, our well-being, our mental well-being. So it's important to have these close friendships. But as everybody knows, maintaining close friendships, especially in this era of Facebook and text messaging, is difficult. It takes a lot of time. If you really want to talk to somebody on the phone or visit them, these are kind of expensive, socially, time-wise, expensive relationships to have. So researchers have had this idea that perhaps we limit the number of friends we have because having too many friends would actually start to maybe negatively impact our life.
Okay, so That's the question. So how did the researchers try to answer it?
Well, they went to school, or they actually did some surveys of some students that were in school. This was a British study. They recruited 24 students that were aged about 17 to 19, and they gave them each an 18-month contract from a major cell phone company with 500 free minutes. That's like the gift of a lifetime for a 17-year-old, and unlimited texting as well. And then they followed them for 18 months. The students lived in the same city in the United Kingdom at first, but over this time period, a lot of them had left for university in other parts of England. And what the researchers did was they tracked not only the amount of time the students spent talking to friends and family on the phone, but just who they were talking to.
So they were talking to friends and family, and some of these are close relationships. Was there a major change when they underwent major life transitions?
Well, the researchers found that there wasn't a big change in the family relationship. So if you always spent 5 hours a week talking to mom on the phone, you still did that. What was interesting is that the friends got swapped around. So if your close friend was Jim and you tended to spend maybe a couple hours a week talking to him or texting, and you went to college and you met a new friend named John, chances are Jim got swapped with John, and now you were spending maybe a couple hours a week texting and talking to John instead of Jim. So you still were spending that time on a friend. It was just a different friend.
Well, let's talk about the caveats here. How broadly can this study actually be applied?
Well, it's a small study, so experts caution that we can't apply it too broadly at this point. But it does really suggest what researchers had long suspected, which is that these close friendships are important, but we can't have too many of them. And as we gain more friends, we may tend to shed the old ones.
Finally, we have a story on fire ant structures. Fire ants can act like transformers. They can group together and form a life raft or a bridge to cross hazardous areas. And these abilities have caught the attention of engineers. Why are mechanical engineers interested in this, Dave?
These bridges these fire ants form are really amazing, and I highly encourage listeners to check out the video of these ants forming a bridge on the website. They basically, between either tree limbs or leaves or other structures in nature, these ants actually form these living bridges. They clump together, and other ants can cross the bridges, and it's just really amazing. What the researchers were sort of interested in this study is these should be fairly flimsy structures, right? Because it's just made of ants. We're not talking about bridges made of concrete or steel. And yet, they're very resilient. If you shake these bridges, the ants maintain the bridge. This is really living architecture that's very strong. And they wanted to figure out how the ants do this.
In the wild, they're forming bridges in order to cross hazardous areas. How did they get them to form a bridge in the lab?
Well, what they did is they put these ants in a couple of funnels that were not too far away from each other, and they had the ants form a bridge. And then they started shaking the funnels, basically, to try to disrupt this bridge. And what they found is that the more they shook these funnels, the ants pulled themselves closer and closer together, really sort of strengthening this bridge. They tightened their grips on one another, and the ants are basically linking arms and legs to form these bridges in the first place. And also that individuals that were scurrying across these bridges tended to change course and gather at the beginning or the end of the bridge to help dampen the effects of the vibrations. And when holes or weak points appeared in the bridges, the ants mended the gaps by linking together at that spot. So there was a very dynamic bridge that these ants had formed. It wasn't just sort of like it couldn't be broken very easily because the ants were always shifting around to make sure that wherever there was a weak spot, they were plugging up that hole, as it were.
These are kind of little self-assembling systems. So is this what makes engineers so interested in it?
Yeah, engineers are really interested in this. Obviously, we would love building materials on our bridges to be able to respond to stress, to earthquakes, and not break and just be able to be very dynamic like these ant bridges are. So this is not just sort of a cool find of nature. It could actually have applications for the human world.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about the lost Agropolis of New England that was found with lasers. Very cool. And also a story about a new insight into just how much what's called biofluorescence is happening in the seas. It turns out a lot more fish are glowing underwater than we knew, and there's some very cool pictures for that. For Science Insider, we've got a wrap-up of some of our most popular stories of 2013, in case you missed them. Also, a story about a billionaire's gift to 6 U.S. cancer centers. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about why preserving large carnivores can save ecosystems. And next week's chat is about how college students decide whether to enter scientific or engineering fields, and also why they decide to drop out. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news, our upcoming live chats, and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.